This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Wednesday, and Senator Sanders is on the road Friday. He's not going to be available for us, so he is dropping by today. And so Senator Sanders is live from someplace. Senator?
We're live from Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. Oh, one of the great cities in America. So what's going on, Senator? It's great to see you this weekend.
We are on the road. You and I were together in L.A. Marianne Williamson put on a beautiful event there.
Yeah.
Sister Giant. And yep. I heard you were great in your remarks. I didn't hear them, but that's what I heard.
Thank you.
And then later on in that afternoon, we went to a Union Hall in L.A. on a beautiful Sunday. Next day, the following day, we had about 500, 600 people. That was a great meeting.
Wow.
And then we went to Las Vegas, and I talked to the culinary workers, and we had filled up the place there. And now I was in Austin last night, and I'm here today, and we had a great meeting at the IBEW headquarters. And I'll be speaking tonight at the Polk County Democrats. And I think what I am finding, Tom, is people are just increasingly disgusted that in a time when the middle class continues to disappear, when people are working longer hours for low wages, when people can't afford health care, can't afford to send their kids to college, can't afford child care, can't afford retirement with dignity, that 99% of all new income is going to the top 1%. And there was a study that just came out recently. I've been talking about it, you know, here in the West. It just literally mind-blowing. And here's what it did. This was in Forbes magazine. And Forbes magazine, which is a magazine for billionaires, keeps track of the progress the billionaires are making. This is what they reported. They said between 2013 and 2015, a two-year period, the 14 wealthiest people in this country, you know, that is Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and the Koch brothers and those guys, they saw an increase in their wealth in that two-year period of $157 billion.
Wow.
Got that?
Wow.
That's right. It is wow. That $157 billion increase in wealth in a two-year period is more wealth than the bottom 40% of the American people own, some 130 million people. It is wow is probably an understatement. It's just extraordinary. It is that we live in a society where the income and wealth inequality is so grotesque that it's really unspeakable. It's hard to describe. $157 billion for 14 people in a two-year period on top of everything else they own. So that we are now living in a nation in which the top one-tenth of 1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. You know, and you know, then I sit, as you know, as the ranking member of the Budget Committee, and I watch my Republican friends, and they say, well, you know, things are really, really tough, and I guess we're going to have to end the Affordable Care Act and cut Medicaid by some $440 billion, which throws 27 million Americans off of health insurance. Because, you know, Tom, we're just a really poor country. Just can't afford to allow 27 million Americans to have health insurance, while 14 families see a $157 billion increase in their wealth in a two-year period. We're just a very poor country, and we have to do what the Republicans told us, cut $90 billion in mandatory funding for Pell Grants. So all over the country, in my state of Vermont, I know, and I know in the other 49 states, you have families saying, look, we would love to see our kids go to college. We just can't afford it. We don't want to see our kids come out $50,000, $60,000 in debt. Republican response is to cut $90 billion over a 10-year period in mandatory Pell Grant funding, which makes it much harder for working-class families to send their kids to college. We don't talk about poverty in America. It's something that politicians don't talk about, media doesn't talk about too often. Yet we have more people living in poverty today than almost any time in the modern history of America. And the Republican response to poverty is to make devastating cuts in nutrition programs so that hunger in America will be increased. So you have two realities. Reality number one is virtually all of the new income in America goes to the top 1%. Republicans are very, very clear. And in their budget, they cut taxes for the billionaire class. And number two, what Republicans are saying, while the rich become phenomenally richer, we've got to continue the war against the middle class and working families of our country. And we are not going to ask the billionaire class to pay a nickel more in taxes. We are not going to ask large corporations, some of which pay zero in taxes in a given year, to pay a nickel more in taxes. But what we will do, and you, is cut education, cut health care, cut nutrition. We have pushed them back on Social Security, but they'll be back. They want to cut Social Security. I was at a hearing recently where this guy was John Engel, the former governor of Michigan. He represents now the Business Roundtable. The Business Roundtable is, as you know, the organization of the largest CEOs in America. All the big corporations are there. They came forward, and you know what their policy is for the United States? They want to raise the retirement age for Social Security to 70, the retirement age for Medicare to 70, and give more tax breaks to the rich. And we had done a little research on the Business Roundtable, and it turns out that the average CEO there gets about, when he retires or she retires, will get $88,000 a month in retirement benefits.
Wow.
About $1 million a year. And they came forward and they said, oh, we want you to make massive cuts in Social Security and Medicare. So the greed that we're seeing, the aggressive greed that we're seeing from the 1% and the war that they are waging against the middle class and working families of this country is just horrific. It is horrific. It is almost unspeakable. And if we don't rally the American people, and if we don't educate, and if we don't organize, this country is going to be moving very rapidly to an oligarchy where ordinary people will have very little political power because of Citizens United, and their standard of living will continue to decline. So, you know, that's where
You're doing kind of an Energizer Bunny tour. It's amazing every place you're going. I'm curious, you're all over the country right now. Are you hearing different messages? Are people's concerns regionalized, or is there?
I don't think so. I mean, we have been, you know, many months ago, I was in the South, and which I think, you know, Democrats very stupidly write off, and I think that just the South is the poorest part of America.
Yeah.
And if people are hurting anywhere, they're hurting in the South, and you can't write them off. But I tell you, since I've been here in the West Coast, in California, Nevada, yesterday we were just in Austin. It was unbelievable. I mean, literally, you could not squeeze another person into that room. I don't know, 500-600 people coming out. And a lot of young people. And the issue that resonates not just with young people, with their parents, is how do you have a great nation if our young people can't afford to get a college education?
Yeah.
How do you do that? In a competitive global economy where most of the new jobs require considerable education, how do you have a strong economy and a great nation if our kids can't get the education that they need? How do you do that? And the other issue, the twin side of that issue, is that you have millions of families today who are paying off these horrendous student debts. I remember last year talking to a young woman in Burlington, Vermont. Her crime was that she went to medical school to become a primary care physician to work with low-income people. Exactly what we need in America. She is stuck with a $300,000 debt. Now, she's a doctor. She'll pay it off.
Wow.
Dentist, $250,000 debt. Completely crazy.
Yeah, it really.
And I think these are the issues that resonate 50 states in America.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. He's only with us for 45 minutes today. He's got to travel on to an event at 45 minutes past the hour. So for the next 30 minutes, he will be taking your calls. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz. Highly recommended. The website's a great news source. Check him out on Facebook, too. So, Senator, shall we pick up some phone calls? Oh, turn it back up. Yep. Senator?
Yep.
Yeah. Shall we pick up some phone calls here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, let's go for it here. Randall in Oceanside, California. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yeah, Senator, I just want to thank you very much for giving up your time every week for this program. Real quick, I want to know, if you become president, will you be proactive for the United States to join the International Crime Commission, considering we cannot self-govern ourselves in cases of torture and war crimes?
Well, I believe very strongly that if the United States stands for anything, Randall, it stands for the fact that we do not torture, that we have a standard that treats people, that sets a code that we are not going to torture and mistreat prisoners. And we do that not only from a moral perspective, but that if we descend into torture, then it's very hard to tell other countries not to do that to our own soldiers if they were ever captured. So I think in every sense of the word, that's the right policy to have.
Rafiq in Humble, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Senator Sanders, I have a statement, not so much of a question. I've spoken with Tina from the Bernie and Friends campaign.
Yep.
And we basically have millions of voters and definitely can raise millions of dollars once you give your official consent that you're going to run for the presidency. And we are totally excited about that. We know that we can bring that revolution that you, not only that you're speaking about, but that this country needs. All right, so I'll clear the air and let the rest of the callers come in. But thank you and keep doing the good work.
Well, Rafiq, thank you. And I am in your state right now, you know, and it's funny. You know, Texas is presumed to be a very conservative state. But, man, what I'm seeing around here suggests otherwise. Let me just answer Rafiq's question. You know, it is no secret, Tom, because we've discussed it many times on the show, that I am giving thought to running for president. And the reason I'm giving thought is just what Rafiq was talking about, is that we do need a political revolution in this country, which says that our government cannot simply be at the service of the billionaire class, that we've got to start dealing with the enormous problems facing the working class, lower income people, the middle class. And we can do these things. We really can. And we can transform America. And what I am, one of the reasons that I'm here on the West Coast is to try to ascertain what kind of support there is. Because when you run the campaign that I would run if I do run, it is taking on the entire establishment. I mean, this is, it's not just the Koch brothers, and it's not just Wall Street, and it's not just the pharmaceutical industry or the private insurance companies or the military industrial complex. It's the whole bunch of it. It's the media and it's everybody else. And it's not an easy campaign. And if you do it, it has to be done well, not just for my own ego. It has to be done well because the banner that I will be carrying is the banner for millions of people. And if we don't do it well, then our opposition says, see, nobody really thinks that we need to make college affordable. Nobody thinks that we need to really have health care for all. Nobody really is worried about income and wealth inequality. Sanders ran and he failed. So that's what the hesitancy is about. That if you do it, you got to do it well, which means that we need a very strong grassroots movement. We need to raise enough money to run a strong campaign.
We'll be right back to Senator Sanders right after this. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls in our Wednesday version of Brunch with Bernie here. Senator Sanders will be with us until 45 minutes past the hour. And Rob in Iron Mountain, Minnesota, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, Tom, thank you for the time. It's where my question is where the Republicans and the conservatives will let the worst in our society thrive while the rest of us, the dreamers, will die. Senator Sanders, please run for president. You know, even if you can't go all the way, we need your ideas out there to be able to take and to challenge what we have out there as far as what's running right now. And my only really grave threat that I think out there that we have as far as on the conservative side, and I'm not kidding, I think Dick Cheney is going to enter this winter race because it's one of those things where you want to energize the base. He's out there. Thank you.
Okay, well, Rob, thanks very much for your support.
Any further comment, or shall we go on to the next call?
No.
Yeah, okay.
I appreciate the support.
Yeah, okay. Susan in Brunswick, Georgia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, thank you, Senator. I wanted to talk about the Affordable Care Act, but first I wanted to say, if you run and Elizabeth as well, you definitely have our vote. I think it's not time for you to run yet. I think this country has to really tank before we can get the Republicans to vote for you. With that being said, I also wanted to speak about my experience with the Affordable Care Act, which is not so good. I just got my taxes done this morning, and I found out that the whole subsidy of $5,000 that I received with the Affordable Care Act, I have to pay every penny of it back. And what I have found out is that when I was calling to first apply for it, the people there that answer the phone, they're not giving the correct information. They first told me that with my husband's Medicare, his Social Security, which is his only income, they were telling me when I first applied that the only amount that they needed was the amount after they take out his Medicare. And then with my job, I do get commission at times. It's sporadic. And my boss also gives me Christmas money, but that she puts in my W-2 form. And when I told them about that, they told me you don't have to put the Christmas bonus in there, and you don't
have to. Susan, pardon my interrupting you. We have a very limited amount of time with Bernie. Is there a specific question you wanted to ask?
Well, my problem is that the people that are answering the phone are not giving the correct information.
Okay, let's let the senator respond to that.
And one of the problems, and thanks for your question, I mean, one of the problems with the Affordable Care Act, of which there are more than a few, is that it is enormously complicated. And that is why, in my view, and I voted for the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has done some very good things. It's provided health insurance for some 16 million Americans who previously didn't have it. It has done away with this obscenity of pre-existing conditions. It has lowered prescription drug costs for seniors. So it's done some good things. But it has done some things that are not so good. And ultimately, it is far more complicated than any sensible healthcare system should be. And I think we have a lot to learn from countries around the world that provide health care to all of their people as a right. In America, after the Affordable Care Act, we still have 35 million people who have no health insurance. And we are still paying almost twice as much per person for health care as any other country. So, what my view is that we should move to cost-effective, universal health care, quality health care, which is Medicare for all through a single-payer system. And I think when we do that, we address the problems that Susan and millions of other people are facing.
Okay. John, in Gilbert, Arizona, got about a minute and a half to the break. John, quick one.
Hey, Bernie, you're a wonderful person. Thank you so much. If you run for president, I would love to see you and Warren as a ticket. Hey, my question is, in Arizona, our worthless Governor Doug Ducey, he just passed a bill on Monday, SB 1315 or 18, I believe. I don't understand how he could do this. He made it so women cannot get insurance through the Affordable Care Act if the insurance company provides abortions. Can you explain how this can happen? And we all know that Republicans always break the laws every given day.
Thank you, John.
Well, look, I'm not all that familiar with what happened in Arizona last week. But what I do know is the Republicans are ideologically bankrupt. They have nothing real to say to the needs of the American people. Their goal is to give tax breaks to billionaires and cut back on the programs that working families need. Basically, that's their agenda. So in order to get votes, what they do is go to certain sections of their base. They have a strong anti-abortion base, and every other week there'll be another attack on women's rights. And they hope that will rally their base. And what our job is to say to people, look, I am, and I should tell you, I am my whole life have been and will be pro-choice. But that we have got to bring people together on basic economic issues so that we do not keep getting divided by right-wing Republicans.
Senator Sanders with us until 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up more of your calls for Bernie in our Wednesday Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman program. Senator's on the road. He won't be available on Friday, so we're doing it right now. Stick around. We'll be back with more Senator Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 202-536-2370.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz. You can also find him on Facebook. He's got a very, very popular Facebook page. Welcome back to the final 15 minutes of our Brunch with Bernie. Actually, it'll be about 12 minutes. Senator Sanders on the line with us, live from Austin, Texas. Pardon me. Senator, you're still with us?
I'm right here.
Okay, great. Kenny, in Columbus, Ohio, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders and Tom. How are you guys doing today?
Great.
Great.
My question real quick, sir, is when are Democrats going to run on the issues that matter to regular people instead of trying to run as Republican lights? This is why you're losing elections, because until I'm going to use Tom's, until he calls, there's two groups of people who vote for Republicans. It's either the very rich or the suckers. And we know who the suckers are. And until they get it, they're going to continue to vote against their own issue, their own interests. But Democrats are not running as Democrats. When are they going to start running again on issues and showing the real differences between themselves? Thank you.
Well, let me tell you something. I think, Tom, that's Kenny who called, right, from
yes.
Ohio?
Yeah, that was Kenny.
Well, he hit it right on the head. I mean, I couldn't say it better. What's happened for a number of years is I think too many Democrats have gotten into the money chase. They spend a huge amount of time trying to raise money, and money is important. That's the sad reality, and it's even more important since Citizens United. But when you spend much of your life raising money from the wealthy and the powerful, you are going to start ignoring the real issues that impact the middle class and working families and low-income people, and you're not going to talk their issues. And the other point is that, in my view, we do not make the changes that we need in this country to protect working families, frankly, unless we are prepared to take on Wall Street and the billionaire class. Now, that's the way it is. I mean, there are certain things that you can do. But at the end of the day, this is the richest country in the history of the world. We are not a poor country. And the fundamental problem with our economy today is that 99% of all new income is going to the top 1%, and that the top 0.1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. And that has got to be dealt with. And let me tell you something. The billionaire class is very powerful. They are extremely greedy, and they have enormous influence over every aspect of our lives. And there are not all that many Democrats who, frankly, are prepared to take them on. So I think Kenny's point is exactly right. You got to draw the lines. Which side are you on? Are you on the side of the billionaire class? Fine. Or are you on the side of working families? And the other point that Ken said is the Republicans have two parts of them. One, the people who own the party, the very, very wealthy, and the other, what he called the suckers. And that is what the Republicans have done brilliantly, is come up with wedge issues, you know, whether it's homophobia, whether it's racism, whether it is sexism, whether it is this, that, or the other thing, and to get people to support them and vote against their own best interests. And our job is to do exactly the opposite, to say to people, look, do you want your kids to be able to go to college or not? Do you want to have a decent wage and raise the minimum wage? Do you want your job to go to China? Do you want health care as a right? And I think if we stay on those issues, we can win a lot of those folks over. I think Kenny made some great points.
Doug, in Oregon, Illinois, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Honored to speak with you, Senator Sanders. You hit on a lot of the points I was going to talk about. Greed is a disease. And obviously these people are sick. They're not dealing with society well at all. You can't act this way in society. But how do you get the message across that greed is a disease and that's what we're being run by when the media is the tail recipient of the big money?
Well, Doug, Tom, we are getting some great questions today. I'll tell you that. You know, it's amazing to me how people see right through so much of the crap that's out there. And you know, Doug hit it right on the head. Let's deal with the 2 points that he made. Everybody, not everybody, but most of the people who are listening, and you and I, I'm sure, know people who have had alcohol problems and have had drug problems. And when you are addicted, that's what addiction means, is you need more and more and more of it. And people kill themselves. They need another drink and another drug, and they kill themselves sometimes or make themselves terribly sick. And I think that Doug is right, is that I think a lot of this, these billionaires, I mean, you tell me what I'm missing here, Tom, but if you were the Koch brothers and you were worth $85 billion, you know, that might be just enough money for you to get by, right?
I think I might just move to Hawaii and sit on the beach.
Right. I mean, you know, you're probably going to be able to pay the rent next year and take care of your kids with $85 billion. But these people are obsessed with trying to destroy Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and the Environmental Protection Agency and get rid of every piece of legislation designed to protect working families in the last 80 years. They want more and more and more. And I think Doug's point is that you really are, in some ways here, dealing with a psychiatric issue of people who cannot control themselves. They have the power. They want more power. They have the money. They want more power. And they don't really care who they step on. And, you know, Doug also mentioned, you know, the media. And media in this country is a very, very serious problem, not unrelated to this. Who do you think owns the media? You think you're talking about the establishment and the billionaire class, and then, oh, and then there's the media. It's not, and there's the media. The media is part of that establishment and that billionaire class. And there are issues that the media will talk about, and there are issues that essentially the media will not focus on. So if somebody gets shot someplace, God forbid, today, it'll be all over the media. But if the Republicans throw 27 million people off of health insurance, I didn't see too many front page stories on that. Did you see that, Tom?
Nope.
Did you see big specials? Republican Party today threw 27 million people off of health insurance in their budget. Didn't see that story. I didn't see the story about what the Trans-Pacific Partnership will do to the American people. In fact, interestingly enough, there was a study. I don't know if it's changed, so I may be wrong on this. But Media Matters reported about a month ago that the TPP, which is the largest trade agreement in the history of the United States of America, was not mentioned on the major TV networks.
Right.
How does that happen? How does that happen? And I can tell you that last year, some senators and I wrote a letter to the heads of the network saying, you know, another study showed you're hardly talking about climate change. Is that because maybe your big energy companies are putting a lot of advertisements on the air? Maybe you don't want to antagonize them. So, you know, Doug is right. Media plays a very important role in our society and in focusing on us on this issue and ignoring many, many other issues. And that's just something we're going to have to deal with.
Kevin, I got your zip code. I don't have the city. Where are you calling from?
Oh, from Lincoln County, Missouri.
There you go. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Oh, Tom, what an honor, sir. Mr. Sanders, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
And I'm sorry if I get a little nervous. I'm a first-time caller. But I've been retired for 3 years, and I've been watching the political system with the Senate and the House every day. And I haven't seen the momentum as that bill of Governor Pence's that they tried to pass that law. It rallied people. Just seemed like over a weekend and something's being done. It made people nervous. And I believe that's the kind of momentum we need to get changes back to the middle class. And my question to you is, how can we keep that momentum going? And thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much for your call and for the comment that you made. And, Kevin, I don't know what it is, what people are eating today, Tom, but everybody seems to be right on the money.
Yep.
And Kevin makes the point that Kevin makes is that the governor of Indiana, Governor Pence, is just defending a horrendous piece of law in the state of Indiana. And that law says that for religious reasons, I can discriminate. Well, we've been through that in the history of this country. You know, that's what the whole civil rights movement was about. People say, well, for my own reasons, for religious reasons or whatever reason, I don't want you know, an African American to come into my restaurant and sit, or to go to a school for religious reasons. Well, we don't accept that. That's what the whole effort in this country to end discrimination is about. And we no longer accept an employer saying, well, I'm not going to hire you because you're Irish. Remember there was a time, no Irish need apply. Remember that sign?
Sure, late 19th century.
No Italians need apply. Blacks not wanted. Asians not wanted. You know, we have made some progress, real progress in this country, getting rid of all of that nonsense. And we're not going to stop. And I have the feeling that what the government of Indiana is now seeing is an American people who are saying loudly and clearly, you're not going to turn back the clock. We're not going back to a discriminatory society. And I think Kevin's point that just in the question of a few days, from coast to coast, people are rising up. And this does tell you, I mean, it also tells you the power of the internet and the social media and what can happen when people get aroused. And Kevin's last point was, well, can we do this on economic issues? And I think we can. It's harder, to be frank with you, it's harder because, you know, you got a lot of sensible corporations out there and business people who may be gay, who have gay colleagues, who are not sympathetic to homophobia, who will deal with this issue. They may not deal with other issues. But I think the line here, the lesson here, is that when people stand up and say something, we can have an impact. And that is what we have to do. We need an aroused public. And I think mostly we need to say that this government does not just belong to the top 1%. It belongs to us all.
There you go. Senator, I know you've got to get on to your next gig. Thanks so much for being with us today.
All right, Tom, great. Take care. Bye.
Great talking. Thank you so much. We will be back. We'll pick up your phone calls here for the next 15 minutes. And then in the next hour, I want to get into a conversation about religion, the whole religious freedom restoration.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, they're using religion in Indiana and elsewhere across the country for arguably political purposes. But what about religion as religion? We'll get into that in 15 minutes. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Senator Sanders had to go. I believe he has a speech to give this afternoon. And so our Brunch with Bernie hour for the week is done, but there's a bunch of people still on the phone lines. No need to start out by saying, I wish Bernie was here, or here was my question for Bernie, because I'm sorry he's not here. You're stuck with me. And so if you just want to talk to Bernie, hang up. On the other hand, if you would like to talk with me, I would be glad to take your call, and I'll start with Floyd in Terre Alta, West Virginia. Hey, Floyd, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Floyd.
Thanks for taking my phone call. I was just wanting to talk about the contamination on the military bases. I just found out that whenever I was in Alabama, that Fort McClellan, that there was all kinds of contamination. I've been sick for years and had no idea why, and I think this may be it.
Hmm.
So I think we need to be looking into this. There's quite a few of us sick that was there.
Yeah.
Monsanto used to have a chemical plant at one of the gates and contaminated Anniston, Alabama, and the base.
Yeah. I may be wrong on the details of this. Like, there might be some sort of exceptions or parameters, but generally speaking, I believe that the Department of Defense is largely exempted from many of the environmental regulations that other businesses and the rest of us have to conduct ourselves by. And I hope I'm wrong on that, but I believe that that's the case. And although they are, you know, going back and cleaning up a lot of these sites, and we are learning a lot of this stuff, and you know what you're talking about, Floyd, and Agent Orange and all that stuff from Vietnam and whatnot, but yeah, it's a tough issue, and it needs more attention. Have you reached out to your two senators or your member of Congress there in West Virginia?
The one senator, and I'm getting ready to file. I've talked to the Veterans Administration, and I've been told to do a claim and go from there. So I've got to meet with a representative and get a claim started.
Yeah.
I hope if there's anybody else out there that's been sick for quite a while, they look into it. There's several places on Facebook, there's different organizations, and that's actually how I found out what was going on about 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
And I've been sick about 2 years after I come home. I've been very I don't know if I'm contaminated or if I'm just getting old and going to die. So,
yeah, just bad luck or something.
Thank you for taking my phone call.
Floyd, thank you so much, and I wish you the very best. If you're not, if you don't get satisfaction from the Veterans Administration or from Senator Manchin or your other, I forget who your other West Virginia senator is there, Senator Sanders' office, Bernie, is on the Veterans Committee. His office will take calls from veterans and or people who have worked on military bases and you know, do what they can. So you might want to call his office, too, if that helps out. Floyd, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you, and I'm sorry, very sorry to hear your story. We'll be back in just a moment with a few more of your phone calls, and then I want to kind of shift the topic back to this whole Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the question of what is religion? Why do we have religion? What does it mean, Mr. Brown? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Joe in Chicago. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. You there?
I am.
Oops. Hello?
Are you there? Joe?
Hello?
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Regarding universal health care, I am a big fan of it, and obviously I'd love to see it happen. My question is, given that health insurance costs are so high in this country on an annual basis, and given on the other side of that about 30% of what we pay, maybe 25%, goes to advertising and unnecessary management fees and high salaries, et cetera, in the health insurance industry, what is the way that we can shift, I guess, politically? Obviously, Congress would have to do something. Shift from our present system to a tax-supported system and cover the costs. I mean, in other words, somehow people's premiums, whether it's somebody that's paying their own premium or their business is paying their premiums, somehow that needs to be shifted to taxes, basically.
Sure.
So that,
like the rest of the world,
so they
does
can
it
pay for the health care? Right. Well, I mean, I would have liked to heard Senator Sanders' answer, but
sure.
I mean,
well, I can tell you what his answer would be.
Is that's
what we should do, and there's a very simple way to do it. We have in this country basically three healthcare systems, or arguably four healthcare systems. We have the healthcare system for the very rich. Right? We've got some very very fancy hospitals, but very expensive. We've got a socialized healthcare system, literally socialist medicine. It's called the Veterans Administration, where the doctors work for the government, and the hospitals are owned by the government. And we have a couple of single payer systems in this country. One is Medicare and the other is Medicaid. And those are both single payer systems. And as you correctly point out, the cost to run a health insurance company, which are basically just banks, these are just banksters, you know, they're skimming 10, 20% off the top, all that kind of thing. But the overhead cost for Medicare and Medicaid is under 3%. So the easy way to do it would have been to have a public option. Joe Lieberman made sure that wasn't possible. They had enough votes for a public option until at the last minute Joe Lieberman pulled out, and that killed the public option on Obamacare. And that public option would have been Medicare. It would have meant that anybody could buy from an insurance company, or they could buy from Medicare. And obviously it would have cost 25% less. The insurance companies didn't like that. So that option is kind of gone. It may come back if we get a Democratic House, Senate, and President. We may well have that back. In the meantime, one of the really cool provisions of Obamacare is that starting in 2017, I believe, at the end of 2016, any individual state can come up with their own health care system so long as it meets the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, which is to say that everybody's covered, no pre-existing conditions, that kind of stuff. And Vermont, set this single-payer system up. Now, they've put it on hold for the moment. I don't think that they've abandoned it. There's an enormous amount of pressure on Governor Shumlin and others in Vermont to try to figure out how to do this. But it's a small state with only 600,000 people, And having lived in Vermont for 10 years, I can tell you probably most of those 600,000 people are in the bottom 50% of, you know, the bottom half of American incomes. It's a relatively poor state. And, you know, generally speaking, it's not quite as bad as Mississippi, but it's very rural and very poor. And I think they, frankly, just didn't have the tax base to support it with an instant transition. So the question is, how do we do this? And can we do this using this brilliant incubator of the states, or is this something that should be done at a federal level? The tragedy, Mojo, is that nobody is having this conversation. When was the last time you turned on any television network and heard a conversation about single-payer health care? Never happens, because the health insurance companies...
I guess the real question that I have is, you have a company, you have several large and small companies that are paying premiums to the insurance companies. Would basically there have to be a way where instead of paying those premiums to the insurance companies, that goes to their taxes and it's no longer deductible.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how feasible that is.
It would be very feasible. It would require raising corporate taxes. And the fact of the matter is that for every 33 cents in taxes that you and I paid in income taxes back during the Dwight Eisenhower administration, or even during the Richard Nixon administration, for every 33 cents that you and I paid in taxes, corporations in America paid a dollar in taxes. Today, for every 33 cents in federal income taxes that you and I pay, corporations pay between 7 and 11 cents. So there's certainly room for corporations, to pick up that slack. And it's not going to devastate the economy, because the economy was doing just fine, thank you very much, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's there.
Unfortunately, the impetus seems to be now, though, even in some, not progressive, but certainly middle-of-the-road entities, to lower corporate taxes.
Right, I know.
That's the impetus.
Well, that's a two-part issue, Joe. The United States has a top marginal corporate tax rate of 35%, which is higher than, I think, pretty much any other developed country, except that most other developed countries have VAT taxes, so they have other streams of tax income into the government, which is always ignored by the people who say we've got the highest corporate taxes in the world. But the reality is that most corporations in America pay somewhere between 10 and 15% in taxes. So if we were to lower that top marginal tax rate from 35% down to 25%, which is sort of the international average, and then close the loopholes and start saying, yeah, you are going to start paying taxes. You've got very profitable corporations that pay absolutely nothing in taxes and say you are going to start paying taxes. That tax money could easily fund a national healthcare system, among other things, and not to mention good infrastructure, good roads, free college education for all our people, which is our intellectual infrastructure. The problem is that because the Supreme Court has said that corporations are persons and therefore protected under the Bill of Rights, and as persons, they can use money as speech and by politicians and by legislation, that it's going to be a real hell of an uphill climb to make that happen. Joe, thank you very much for the call. You really put your finger on it. As Bernie said, great calls today. In the next hour, I want to talk about where did religion come from? How does it come about? What does it mean? What do we do about it with it? And what does it have to do with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the third hour of our program, by the way, Craig Holman is going to drop by. He's the lobbyist for Public Citizen, their government affairs lobbyist, previously a senior policy analyst at the Brennan Center. We're going to talk about how the president, with an executive order, could unmask some of these large corporate donors and billionaire donors. It would be a really, really interesting thing. But anyhow, we'll have that conversation in an hour. Mike Pence has a bunch of interesting things here. Tom the Dancing Bug, right? Reuben Bowling's doing his cartoon today. He says, "Lo, in the land of Indiana did come to a baker two men who lie with one another." And there's two gay men. Baker says, "Sorry, I'm not going to sell you a cake." Yay, a new law in the land allowed the baker to discriminate against such people. I'm required to, it's my religion. And then did come to the baker a woman with her head uncovered, and he did refuse her business. Wait, what? Verily, for that was explicitly prohibited by his religious text, which he did follow strictly. Yes, in fact, even in the New Testament, it says women should cover their heads. It's right. I think it's in Paul's letter to the Romans. So he's looking it up in the Bible going, whoa, you're right. And the woman leaves without her headscarf. And then a man comes in. Then did come to the baker a man of great riches and many possessions. And he says, my company needs 500 cakes a week. But lo, did the religious baker refuse his business, for he did follow all his religious texts and teachings. The baker goes, oh, come on, that camel through the eye of a needle thing? Was that meant to be taken seriously? You know, basically Jesus said, rich people aren't going to get into heaven. Well, if you don't want to hang out with people who aren't going to go to heaven, if you don't want to serve them, maybe you should stop serving rich people. So it came to pass that the baker had no customers, and he was soon upon bankruptcy and ruin. And then the two men who lie with each other, in other words, two gay men, did return to him with a kind offer of patronage. We'd like to buy a cake. And the baker says, but why would you forgive me? And the two guys say, we're required to. It's our religion. And the baker says, this takes all the fun out of discrimination. This is Tom the Dancing Bug cartoon. NASCAR, by the way, not an April Fool's joke. NASCAR came out today and said, hey, enough of Indiana. But I wanted to talk about this idea of religion in general and open it up to a conversation with you during this hour about religion. It seems to me, and I may be very incomplete in my understanding and analysis of this, but it seems to me that there are four principal dimensions to religion historically. The first and arguably most ancient, although actually I think probably most of these go way, way back. The first is an attempt to explain the unexplainable. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do people die? Why did that earthquake happen? Why did that tsunami happen? Why, et cetera. And in many ways, in early religions in particular, were attempts to explain those things. Oh, it's Thor and Odin, the thunder gods up in the sky there above Norway pounding on their anvils. And that's the lightning and the thunder that you hear. Or, oh, it's the battle of the gods in the sky or whatever. So an attempt to explain the unexplainable. In that regard, for that dimension of religion, there's still a lot of unexplainable. And there's still a lot of religious attempts to explain that. But the real obvious stuff, why do we get sick? Why do tsunamis happen? Why earthquakes? Those kind. Science has largely replaced religion in many of those areas. And that seems like a reasonable thing. So that's number one. Number two is religion historically has been about community. This is my group. This is my tribe. This is my community. These are the people who view the world the way that I do, who understand how, we have a shared experience. I have a friend who's Mormon, one of the people who works with me over at RT. And she's not a, quote, practicing Mormon in that she doesn't consider herself a religious Mormon. In fact, she thinks that a lot of the tenets of Mormonism are kind of silly. But she participates because it's her community. It's her people. It's her family. It's her extended family. Now, Mormonism can get pretty rigorous about this. If you leave, you get not just excommunicated, but, relatives refuse to talk to you. And I mean, it gets pretty strange. But community is an important part of religion. It's a this is who we are. Then there are two other pieces to this that I think are quite interesting. The third, and again, these to some extent are being replaced by other things, right? The community of religion is being replaced by neighborhood. It's being replaced by television. It's being replaced by social media. It's being replaced by institutions, schools, things like that, in ways that are very different from hundreds or thousands of years ago, where the religious institutions were the principal places where people got together. And in fact, even in the modern era, it was out of the Christian churches, by and large. For example, the Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement moved. It was out of both the Christian and the Jewish, and I'm assuming there was probably an Islamic portion of this as well, back in the early part of the 20th century, who were and possibly Hindus and Buddhists who were working on enfranchising women. That led to the 19th or 20th Amendment that gave women the right to vote and you know, that sort of thing. But so the community, but the community aspect of religion seems to be slightly diminishing. The third aspect that seems to be slightly diminishing, or even to some extent anachronistic, is rules. Rules to live by. Now, you will hear, and in fact, I've had this discussion and even debate with people on this program. You will hear people assert that lacking religion, we would have no morality. I don't have the quote right in front of me, but Thomas Jefferson went off on this at incredible length over and over and over again. There are so many quotes from Jefferson about what a stupid idea that is. And in fact, there were those people, David Hume, the British historian back in Jefferson's time, was asserting that British common law was based on Christianity, and Christianity was the moral foundation of it. And Jefferson says, this is a joke. For 200 years, you had the Heptarchy, you had a series of kings in England before Christianity was introduced. He said, we didn't need to look in musty books. We looked in our hearts and in nature and found there the way to live. So there's rules. So what are our rules? And then finally, and so again, this is, I think without religion, we can still figure out rules. Although, you know, many of the rules in religion are actually ways to strengthen community. And in that regard, I would think that they're marvelous things, as long as they're functional. Now, you could argue, you know, to the extent to which ISIS is promulgating rules, that's dysfunctional. And then the fourth piece of this is transcendence. And this is the part that is least often discussed. And I think it's the most important part of religion. And that is the personal experience of something greater than oneself. The experience of, that's what it is. And whether it's interpersonal, interworld, or between a person and something that they just absolutely can't explain but much greater than them. It's a powerful thing. So taking these four pieces, and whatever other pieces you can point out to me, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How do we re-understand and reconcile things like this so-called Religious Freedom Act in Indiana? What is this? How does this fall into these categories? You'll also recall that yesterday or the day before, Monday or Tuesday, I went off on a long rant about Matthew 25, about, you know, how in the New Testament, Jesus was basically saying, the disciples came to him and said, how do we get to heaven? He says, there's only one way. When I was hungry, you know, if you're going to go to heaven, if you fed me when I was hungry, if you gave me water when I was thirsty, if you gave me clothes when I was naked, if you housed me when I was homeless, if you visited me when I was in prison, and if you healed me when I was sick, period. And the disciples all freaked out and said, oh, my God, we never saw you. I mean, oh, my Lord, oh, Jesus, we never saw you hungry. We're doomed. And Jesus said, as you did to the least among you, you have done unto me. The essence, not just of Christianity, but of all religions. So, is that a rule? Or is that a principle by which we conduct ourselves, by which we live our lives? Am I missing something here? I mean, I've dug quite deep. I've dove quite deep throughout my life in Christianity and to a secondary extent in Judaism, not so much in Islam. I spent a couple of years very interested in Hinduism and Buddhism, and spent a week with the Dalai Lama and took refuge from him, so I guess I'm technically a Buddhist. But each one of these, every one of these, I have a good friend who's a Hasidic Jew. And, you know, we've had these long conversations about, you know, for example, he can't wear clothing that's made out of two different kinds of fabric because it's banned in Deuteronomy. There's these 635 laws, I think, that are in Deuteronomy in the Old Testament about how to conduct yourself. And it's like, do you really think you're going to go to hell if you're wearing, you know, polyester and cotton? And he's like, no, but it's what we do. It's how we know who we are. Keeping kosher, keeping, you know, whatever it may be, these things, these are ways of being in the world. So the net of this, and I want to repeat this again right after the break, is it seems to me that what is happening is that the people who believe that religion is mostly about rules and tribe/community are circling the wagons and so saying, okay, these are our rules. Like they want to exclude gay people from functionally from society or women. These are their rules. And now they're trying to put those into legislation. In fact, Indiana and Mike Pence just did. And it seems to me, and again, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. It seems to me that if we could start having serious conversations in the United States about the transcendental nature of religion, about finding deep meaning in life through religion, about the community aspect of religion, that we might be way ahead of the game instead of just trying to figure out what are the appropriate rules that some divine being wants us to live by. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. So here's where I think that much of the conversation that we're having in the United States about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, in quotes, that is happening over in Indiana, how we're missing the boat on this. In fact, actually, I wanted to just share a quick, this was over at Democratic Underground. Indiana Pizza Shop, the headline, Laura Clausen writing, Indiana Pizza Shop won't serve gays. Owner says, we're not discriminating against anyone. We just won't serve gay people, right? She says, if a gay couple came in and wanted us to provide pizzas for their weddings, we would have to say no, says Crystal O'Connor of Memories Pizza. We're not discriminating against anyone. That's just our belief. Anyone has a right to believe in anything. Well, you know, we spent a lot of time yesterday sort of ridiculing this notion on its face. How do you know someone's gay? What if you think someone's gay and they're not? And all those kind of things. I mean, I guess if it's a gay wedding, you pretty much know. But in any case, she went on to say, though, and this is where I think it's really interesting. She went on to say, I don't think it's targeting gays. I don't think it's discrimination. It's supposed to help people that have a religious belief. It seems to me that what's going on is that the people who believe that religion is all about rules, or principally about rules, are trying to, and not just trying, are succeeding in converting those rules from religious rules, from here's how we live rules, here's how we worship rules, here's how we conduct ourselves relative to each other rules, into legal rules, into law, which is absolutely at variance, at odds with the founding principles of this country, which are religious pluralism. as the Treaty of Tripoli started out, you know, written during the George Washington administration, actually signed by the John Adams during his administration, starts out by saying, as the United States is in no way a Christian nation or a nation founded on Christianity, and goes on to say that, you know, we welcome all religions. But it seems that the folks who are just obsessed with the rules are missing everything else, or the rules and the community piece of it. This is our community. We're going to be this, you know, and that's when religion even can become very toxic. That's the Jim Jones, the polygamous cults in Utah, the, you know, on it goes. That's where that gets problematic. So the conversation that I think we're missing, and maybe this is just me. Maybe it's just that, you know, my experience in life, literally throughout my life, has been one of being drawn to religion because of transcendence, because of the experience of the ineffable. Not trying to understand anything. Not trying to figure out, oh, this is how I should conduct myself. I really think, you know, you talk to Aboriginal, Indigenous people who've never heard of any of these modern religions, particularly the monotheistic religions. They're perfectly moral people. Some of their moral and political and cultural systems are even far more sophisticated than ours. Peter Farb, in his book Man's Rise to Civilization, and the story of the first contact with 34 different Native American groups in the United States in the 1600s, writes about how the Shoshone, a tribe with a population density of 100 people per square mile out in Nevada, had rituals and customs that he said would make the Palace of Versailles look simple. There's a lot of complexity there. I remember when I was 7 years old, my mom, who was the religious one in our family, I didn't know my dad was an atheist until just before he died, but my mom always took us to this Methodist church down the street from where we lived on Sundays. And there was this couple, this elderly couple. I've told this story before. My apologies if you've heard it before. I'll try to be brief. But it's been a while. There was this old farming couple, and they were probably my age now, but I was 7 years old, so they were old people. And they had this farm outside of Lansing, and they invited all the kids to come out there to spend a nice Saturday on the farm. Or maybe it was a Sunday after church, I don't remember. And we're sitting, and this was one of my first really moments of aha about the whole thing. The kids were all out playing on it was a farmhouse, a big lawn, and then you could see, and the farmhouse was up on a little bit of a hill, and you could see for miles. You could see the fields, you could see the roads, you could see the trees lining the roads and things like that. And there was a little card table set up with lemonade on it, and the old farmer guy was sitting on one side of it, and I was sitting on the other side of it. His wife was in the house. The kids were down playing. I've always been a bit of an introvert, and would rather just sit and talk with one person than, in fact, I get nervous around crowds of people. So anyhow, I'm sitting here with this guy, and he says, look at the sky. Look at how blue it is. And I'm like, yeah, that's amazing. And you see the white clouds just kind of fluffing along in there? Yep. And he said, can you hear the cars in the distance? Can you hear the wind in the trees? I was like, yeah. He said, smell the grass. I cut the grass yesterday. Can you still smell it? Can you smell it? I was like, yeah, I can smell it. He said, can you still taste the lemonade? Yeah, I can still taste the lemonade. He says, you can feel the seat that you're sitting on. You can feel that we're sitting on the earth and it's holding us here. And I was like, yeah, I'm here. And then he leans over like he's going to say share this great secret with me. And in this whisper, this loud whisper, he says to me, it's all alive. And I looked out at the sky and the trees and the cars and the grass and and suddenly it hit me from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet that it was all alive and I was all alive and it was all the same thing. And to this moment, I get goosebumps when I think of that. That's what I think religion is. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So how is it even possible for us to change the conversation in America from religion being about rules to transcendence? Wouldn't it be a great thing? Welcome back, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you and pleased to be with you. Wouldn't it be a great thing if... boing, boing, boing. Wouldn't it be a great thing if this craziness not only engendered a national conversation about, which it already has to a large extent, the discrimination against gay people, but also began a conversation about the appropriate role of religion in politics, in society, and even how religions change, evolve, grow, the positive and negative sides of religions, how we can, what we can do with these things. There's so much there, it seems to me. So much that can be held in conversations I'm starting to blither here, but last week we were talking with Ani Zonneveld about Islam and about the progressive Islam, is progressive Christianity. United Church of Christ is big on that. Let's pick up your phone calls. And I said I wanted to toss this out to the world. Let's see what the world has to say. Richard, driving through Utah. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
Great. What's on your mind?
It's funny, the conversation you're having today, this kind of reverts back to a conversation you and I had on Monday. I called and I was referring to you about the phrase God-fearing, as opposed to people who are really in fear of what their preachers are telling them.
Right.
And one of the things that I've realized over my years in studying, like, world history is that religion, if you look at most of, especially, like, European monarchies, and then, the New World after discoveries in the mid, 1700s, when Christianity really became more of a worldwide religion instead of a localized European thing. Everybody who ruled only really ruled with the blessing of whoever the religious leader was at that time.
Well, in the United Kingdom, the coins, I believe to this day, it certainly was the case a couple of years ago, the coins have four letters on them, which in Latin, I forget what the letters are, but one of them stands for Rex, king. But what they say in Latin, or what they stand for in Latin, is she rules by the grace of God.
Exactly.
It's about the queen.
Religion, even though it's, I agree with your four tenets that you came out with, especially the one of explaining away things that people did not understand.
Right. Trying to make meaning out of meaninglessness or apparent meaninglessness.
Exactly. And that kind of gave people a certain amount of power over those around them who were less knowing. And, as we all know, power tends to corrupt.
Yeah. And that's there are classic examples of that, Richard. When I lived in Germany, I heard the story and it's a common knowledge. I think they teach it in the schools there, that before Christianity in Germany, or in that, in that part of Northern Europe where the winters are very, very short, right? The farther north you go, you get down to where you got, daylight for 6-8 hours and you go up to Norway, you get daylight for a half hour, right? And on the shortest day of the year, the priests had figured out how to use these calendar stones, the Stonehenge kind of thing. They knew what the shortest day of the year was, roughly December 23rd, 24th. And on the shortest day of the year, they would find the biggest tree on the tallest hill, and they would just set that sucker on fire, light it up, get all the people there, and they say, I'm going to reignite the sun, and they'd set that pine tree on fire, and it would burn like crazy, and then the next day would be a little longer, and the next day would be a little longer, and everybody would go, he brought the sun back, he did it again, and he'd have another year of power. And you know, we call those Christmas trees now. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Richard. Excellent point. Joel in American Fork, Utah. Hey, Joel, what's up?
Not too much. I actually moved up to Park City. I used to live in American Fork last year. But on your point, I'm an observant Mormon. I agree with a lot of your four tenets of religion. I'm a little bit conflicted on this whole deal. I'm certainly no fan of the Indiana law. I think we need to have the free expression of religion, and I kind of look at it this way. You know, everybody's been using the example of the baker that didn't want to make one for the gay wedding. I don't understand exactly why everybody's first notion is litigation. I kind of use this for an example. If I'm a member of the Summit County Gun Club and I walk into a flower shop and I say I want an arrangement that looks like a rifle, and the owner said, no, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. We don't believe in violence. My first reaction would be like, okay, I'll go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know how the baker turned him down, whether they were polite about it, whether they were rude. That would make a big difference to me. But
Joel, being a member of the gun club is a behavior and a choice. And what the growing consensus in the United States, and I think, you know, it's been long known. I mean, even either Jesus or Paul, I think it was Jesus, yeah, said, you know, some men are born eunuchs, some choose to be eunuchs. And I think it was a reference to being gay. In other words, you know, they're not with women. And in fact, look at all the disciples. I don't think that, you know, being a member of the gun club is a choice. Being gay and wanting to marry your partner, I don't think that that's choice. I think that's who we are. That's identity. There's a difference between choice and identity.
I'm not going to disagree with you there. I don't necessarily disagree. Yet the same idea is that I don't know. I guess I'm one of the people that kind of looks at things and says, well, not everybody's going to like me no matter what it is.
No, I understand. And in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially the argument you're making is if I run a business and somebody offends me, I should be able to not serve them. It's the old no shoes, no shirt, no service thing. Is that essentially the argument you're making?
Well, no, I'm more making the argument from the idea of the consumer. Whatever the business does, if I don't, that's kind of where it's, you know, it's, I'm.
Oh, so you're making the argument that the free market will solve the problem because consumers will go someplace else and the bigots will go out of business. Okay. I understand that. But again, this doing business, that assumes that doing business in the United States is a right. And it's not a right. It's a privilege. You have to apply for a business license. You have to apply. You have to go to the Secretary of State and become a corporation. It's not a right. It's a privilege. And as a privilege, it's a privilege to conduct business in this country within certain parameters. I'm running a business here, this radio show. There are certain parameters that we have to follow. We have to, you know, you have to file your taxes. You have to pay your people appropriately. You have to have appropriate compensation. You have appropriate working conditions, you know, on and on and on it goes. And if you can't conduct yourself within the rules of business, of rational business, then don't have a business. The reason why we allow business in the United States is to provide for some sort of social good. And when businesses become toxic to social good, they no longer, in my opinion, have a justification for existence.
But that sounds great on paper, but you never know what anybody is going to say what the social good is.
Well, okay, and this is where it gets crazy. This is over at Stop Hurting America's posting over at Daily Kos. I am a Christian business owner in Indiana. And this is a perfect one for April 1st here. They're posting this on the front door of their business. Dear valued patrons, due to my sincerely held religious beliefs and in light of the RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, recently signed by our dear leader Pence, I will no longer be doing business with the following persons, nor permitting them in my establishment. Number one, divorcees. Matthew 19:9 says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Number two, anyone who has ever read their horoscope or called a psychic hotline, Leviticus 26. As for the person who turns to mediums and spiritualists I will set my face against that person and will cut him off from among his people. Three, anyone with a tattoo, Leviticus 19:28, you shall not make any cuts on your body or for the dead or make any tattoo marks on yourselves. I am the Lord. Number four, anyone born illegitimately. Also, anyone who back to 10 generations is descended from anyone born illegitimately. If you cannot prove, using appropriate church sources, that 10 generations of your family were born in wedlock, I will have to throw you out of my place. Deuteronomy 23:2, no one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord. Number five, and he goes through this list. I mean, it's basically, you know, he's going through Deuteronomy. And it's like, where do we draw the lines? The lines should be religion. You know, I don't have a problem if a church wants to discriminate, right? If the Catholic Church wants to say, we're not going to let, Protestants conduct a wedding in our little area up in front, the sacristy or whatever.
Mormons don't let non-Mormons get married in the temple. We'll use that example.
Yeah, for example. That is perfectly reasonable, right? It's like, this is my club.
I agree with that.
But that's a whole different thing than running a business.
I agree with that. I agree with you 100% there. We're in complete agreement.
Okay, good. All right.
In that area.
All right. In that case, I'm going to move along, but I only have about 20 seconds, so I'll just finish this Christian business owner, and then we'll pick up some more phone calls. He says, this is the people he will not allow into his business now, this business owner in Indiana, tongue-in-cheek, of course. Anyone who makes a practice of praying out loud or in public, because in Matthew 6, Jesus said, when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so they can be seen by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you pray, go to your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. He says, number six, any woman with braided hair or gold jewelry. 1 Timothy 2:9. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Hey, at what point have we officially gone insane as a nation? We'll be back. Welcome back, Marty in Monroe, North Carolina. Hey, Marty, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Just an apology to you, sir, for making you upset the last time we chatted. I didn't mean to cross the line and make you upset. I admire you. I think what you're doing, and you know,
Marty, I don't recall being upset. What happened?
When we were talking about the fiasco in Indiana,
right?
I said the only people that were going to get hurt were the business owners,
right?
And that's what I was saying, and. I guess our line of thought and communications got crossed. You got upset with me, and that was not my intention.
I see. Well, Marty, thank you for the call.
I do offer you a sincere, humble, heartfelt apology for that.
Well, thank you, Marty. That's very considerate of you, and I apologize if I had offended you in any way.
But the topics that you and I can talk on would take a year's worth of Sundays, and
we don't have
that kind of time.
No doubt about it. Okay, Marty, thanks for the call. I look forward to conversing with you on this and other topics in the future. I appreciate your kind concern. Although, that said, I have really thick skin. It takes an awful lot to, you know, I mean, I will respond with passion and purpose or whatever the phrase is, but to get me hurt or angry takes an awful lot. It's pretty hard to do. Brian in Matthews, North Carolina. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Yes, sir. Right down the street from Monroe, Carolina, I believe.
Great.
The question I want to ask, Tom, first of all, good afternoon. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
How much do these people really believe in the book and religion and God and so on? If you truly knew something was going to occur. Well, no, if you suspected something was going to occur, it would be in the form of retribution or payback or what have you. Would you still do them if you really believed that it was going to happen to you?
Can you give me a real-world example or a hypothetical example?
For example, if God was going to strike you down in some way or if he was going to cast upon you some kind of evil or whatever, not evil, but
For example, in the Ten Commandments, it says if your next-door neighbor is worshiping a bull, you have to go over and kill him. Or it says that if your kids talk back to you, you have to stone them to death. If you refuse to do that and you're thus defying God's will, should you worry that God's going to get you? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. How much do you believe it if you do the stuff that you're doing anyway? I mean, isn't it just a farce on its face? Because I'm afraid of you, of some sort of retribution. You know, if you're going to still, you know, exact punishment, if you're going to persecute people.
That's a, you know, Brian, that's a really good point, because it seems that there are kind of two categories of folks who consider themselves religious and conduct their lives with religion at the basis of it. And some of them are people who are afraid of an angry God. You know, the old Cotton Mather, you know, the fear of the angry God. The Lord holds you like a spider above the flames of hell. I actually, you know, when I was in high school, I recited that for drama class. And the other are the people who are in love with religion, who find love in their religion, who find meaning, who find deep meaning in their religion, I'm sure there's some crossover between the two, but it really seems to me that most people are either motivated by fear or by love, by moving away from pain or moving toward pleasure. And I think, frankly, if we want to have a religious restoration in this country, in all faiths, we need to be emphasizing the moving toward pleasure and de-emphasizing the moving away from pain. We'll be back. Thank you, Brian. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you 10 minutes before the hour. I want to check in with the Talk Radio News service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And, just a quick FYI, at the beginning of the next hour, Craig Holman is going to drop by with Public Citizen, and then we can continue this conversation about religion, about Mike Pence, about anything else you'd like to get into. But let's find out what's going on in the world right now, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen's charity. She just got back from South Sudan, where that is, and free-don.org. Hey, Ellen.
Hi, how are you? Well, there's quite a bit going on. The White House said that in terms of Arkansas, that they believe that discrimination is not the way to go, and discriminating for two people on the basis of who they love, and so they were actually very supportive of Governor Hutchinson of Arkansas.
Yeah, now for people who don't know about this, Arkansas just passed the same law that Indiana did, and Asa Hutchinson, the governor, said, I don't want to sign this thing. And in fact, in his press conference, he said his son signed a petition begging him not to sign the bill.
Amazing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, speaking of petitions, this is a little off my topic, but I'll go right to it. There's going to be a petition that is delivered to the White House tomorrow morning with over 500,000 Americans to ask the president to sign an executive order asking businesses with federal contracts to disclose their election spending.
Wow.
Now, that would be pretty amazing.
Yeah, we will be talking about that, in fact, on this program in about 12 minutes.
And the top 100 contractors take in over $150 billion in American tax dollars. Pretty astounding. Okay, so now the president signed an executive order. Today he authorizes the Treasury Secretary, along with the Attorney General and Secretary of State, to impose sanctions on individuals who engage, they say, in malicious cyber-enabled economic activity. It's very interesting. The press briefing is going on now. People are not focused on that, even though I think they should be. They're focused on Iran, and I'm going to be talking about that in just a minute.
Now, the word malicious instead of the word criminal, what does that mean?
Well, it's hard to name somebody a criminal unless you actually take them to court, right? Innocent until proven guilty is part of our Constitution, even if they originate in China.
Right.
So I think to use the word malicious is better than using the word criminal, because criminal implies some kind of court.
Yeah, it's a lower legal bar, and yet it still allows some sort of a response.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay.
Exactly. Okay. Now, the... the let's just talk a little bit about Iran, because this is where the press is absolutely focused today. As you know, there are still talks going on in Lausanne, Switzerland, and the Secretary of State there and the Secretary of Energy is there. Now, why is the Secretary of Energy there? Apparently, he is very knowledgeable about nuclear deals. And,
yeah, he's the bomb guy.
Exactly. So he is there now. They say that they are making progress, that they are willing to walk away. They're willing to make a nuclear option, but they said if they have a nuclear option, then Iran has no benefit. I mean, they're going to kick out all the inspectors, and right now they have inspectors there, and they have some knowledge about what Iran is doing.
Right.
And so that is why they don't want to walk away at this point. They say that they, if Iran does not agree, that one of their options is obviously a military option, but the other option is to impose even tougher sanctions and to get the international community to agree. And they say the sanctions now has pushed Iran to the table, and even tougher sanctions they think will produce more Iranian willingness to negotiate. And they also want, they say, these were the exact words, and he used them a few times today. This is Josh Ernst, the press secretary. The intrusive inspections.
Right. Well, Iran has already agreed to that. I mean, they signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement. They have UN inspectors there. They've had them there for years. Israel has done neither of those two things, by the way. And there's no evidence that Iran is actually developing military nuclear capability. I mean, they're doing energy and they're doing medical.
Right.
Why doesn't the average American know this?
Well, I have no idea. And, you know, I mean, one person to get involved or group of people might be the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on to another difficult country, and that is Iraq. Finished with Iran, now to Iraq. We have been getting mixed reports on the state of the battle in Tikrit, which, of course, is where Saddam Hussein was from originally. White House is saying now that Iraqi forces have advanced into the heart of Tikrit, and they've advanced into the city center. And they say that Iraqi security forces were able to do this by using a multi-sectarian force under the command of the Iraqi military. Now, who knows whether that's going on? They were also asked about Mosul, and the White House said that there are more civilians in Mosul, so that they want to be much more careful about that.
Right. To what extent is this a war between warlords, a war between religious sects, or
a war? I think it's hard to say, and I also want to say, being that I've spent so much time recently in Africa, that sometimes a warlord and a religious sect can be the same.
Sure.
And that's the problem, because sometimes people who run these religious sects really are warlords masquerading as a religious opportunity.
Well, as was the case in Europe for 1,000 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I love the way you put it, Tom Hartman.
Thank you.
Okay. The Secret Service, there are some questions going on about that and whether the director is bowing to the inspector general, whether the inspector general is going to let the individual agents that got into trouble testify. White House sort of skated on that question today completely.
Interesting.
Now, on one or two other issues, the United Nations, the Secretary General met, that's Ban Ki-moon, he met yesterday with the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran. They said that they're very concerned about the situation in Yemen. Now, this has been going on a lot.
Yeah, Yemen, keep your eyes on that one.
For sure.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm pleased and honored to have in the studio with me Craig Holman, Ph.D., Dr. Holman.
Glad to be here.
Welcome
Tom.
To the program. He is Public Citizens Government Affairs Lobbyist, previously the Senior Policy Analyst at the Brennan Center, another great organization. But citizen.org is your home right now.
Yes.
And tell me what you're up to.
It's an amazing campaign that we've got set up that's really going to occur mostly tomorrow. What we're doing is we're trying to get the president to, with a stroke of the pen, open up the books on all the dark money that has flowed into our elections ever since the Citizens United decision in 2010. As you know, since 2010, we've had about $600 million in money flowing into our elections that we have no idea where it came from.
Right.
And
we're not even sure that it's just that amount of money.
Yeah, we're not even sure of that. But we do know there's been this huge increase in spending from sources of funds that we don't see. Just to highlight how big of an impact it had, right after Citizens United that ruled that the five justices ruled that corporations shall be treated as people under the First Amendment, we saw a fourfold increase in outside spending in the 2010 elections. And that was just corporations for the first time, like, dipping their toes in the political water, saying, can we really get away with this? And then they realize they can not only get away with it, they can also hide their identities by laundering this money through nonprofit groups. So once they realized that, in the 2012 elections, we saw another fourfold increase.
Katie, bar the door.
So this is dark money taking over our elections. Once we go into 2016 elections, you can imagine, I mean, at this point, we know of $600 million in unknown money.
Right.
And every election has broken that record. 2016 is going to be a watershed election when it comes to dark money, unless we can get President Obama to pull out his pen and issue an executive order requiring that corporations that do political spending and receive a federal contract disclose their political spending.
Right.
With the stroke of the pen, the White House could actually open up the books on all this dark money.
Or much of it.
Or much of it.
Yeah. And my understanding is that that $600 million figure, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, this is your business, not mine, but typically the way that we calculate the amount of money going into politics is by measuring how many ads are bought on television and radio, knowing what they cost, looking at the cost of mailings and things. But the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity have built a nationwide on-the-ground infrastructure, renting offices, hiring people. There are even some who suggest that it is larger and more effective right now than the Republican Party, certainly in many states. Is that included in that? Is that measured, or is that dark, dark money? Is that totally below the radar money?
And that falls outside the radar, where we can identify $600 million in unaccounted for money is in terms of what political committees report as their expenditures. Those will usually be TV ads, radio ads, flyers, and their political committees.
Right.
So these are the committees that are reporting expenditures, including nonprofits that do something like electioneering communications or independent expenditures. So we know about that money being spent. But when it comes to having a network of secretive organizations doing on-the-ground work, and they try to claim that it's not political electioneering, it's more issue advocacy,
right,
that will fall completely under the radar. So we do have much more dark money than that $600 million figure.
Right.
It's startling. What I find even more startling is the fact that we haven't been able to get any particular agency or Congress to actually agree with the American public. When you do public opinion polls of Americans, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, you'll find 80% of Americans say, first of all, corporations have too much power in our elections, but all this spending must be public. It must be transparent. We haven't been able to get Congress to pass the Disclose Act to impose transparency. We are pushing the Securities and Exchange Commission to impose transparency on publicly traded corporations. And now we're pushing the White House to issue this executive order, and we just might get this executive order, actually.
Does any of this have anything to do with the posters that I saw in Union Station yesterday that say, "Where is Mary Jo White?"
Yes, it does.
Tell me about this.
This is fantastic. About 2 years ago, 10 law professors filed a petition with the Securities Exchange Commission asking SEC to impose a transparency requirement on publicly traded corporations.
Right. The SEC basically regulates mm-hmm. any company that sells stock in the public marketplace.
That's right, and it has the authority to require those companies to disclose their political spending if they see it relevant to shareholders,
right.
which it is. I mean, it's shareholder money.
Sure.
However, the SEC has, even though they've been inclined to support this idea, they don't put it on their agenda. Well, for 2 years, we've been doing very straightforward, you know, work trying to get them to put it up on their agenda. We've got 1 million comments submitted to the SEC from the American public asking for that transparency rule to come out of the SEC. And Mary Jo White just keeps setting aside.
She is the executive director
of
chairman of the SEC.
And so the new campaign that we just unfolded this week is, you know, we've got this ad campaign right in the Metro Station in Union Station where all the SEC commissioners come to work.
I walked by it this morning.
And it's saying, where's our hero, Mary Jo White? You could actually open up the books on this money. Where is Mary Jo White?
Right.
You know, we're not trying to be mean to Mary Jo White. We're just trying to elevate the issue on her agenda.
Right.
And this might do it.
And just to kind of clarify this all and talk about the slices, because we're slicing and dicing here, the business money there and the billionaire money for that matter. If there was to be legislation that said that any money that was spent on politics had to be reported, which is frankly what Scalia said in the decision in Citizens United would be the solution to the problems that John Paul Stevens identified in his dissent. He said simply mandate transparency by legislative action.
Right.
If that was to happen, that is not something the president could do. That would have to be done by Congress if it just covered everything. However, the president has the authority to impose or define standards for behavior for corporations that get government money, that have government contracts. And Mary Jo White, as the head of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, has the power to impose regulations or control the behavior within certain limitations of companies that sell their stock on the New York Stock Exchange and other stock exchanges. So those two are not all the companies in America, and they're certainly not all the billionaires in America. What percentage of the political money that's out there do you think would be captured by either of those, respectively?
By the executive order, we know a real lot of it would be captured. We've done a rather brief analysis of the 41 largest corporate political spenders. And of those 41 largest, 33 are federal contractors. So we're talking about capturing a huge swath of it. Think about it. I mean, these federal contractors tend to be the largest corporations in the U.S.
Sure.
And they're the ones who have the most at stake when it comes to trying to influence government contracts. And so they're the ones who tend to be the most politically active. But you are right, Tom. I mean, the best way of doing this would be to get Congress to pass the Disclose Act.
Right.
Then we'd have full donor disclosure of all the money everywhere. But, you know, it looks like a difficult road to go through, at least for the next 2 years when it comes to Congress. So we're pursuing every avenue we can think of.
We're talking with Craig Holman, Dr. Craig Holman, Public Citizens Government Affairs Lobbyist, formerly with the Brennan Center. Citizen.org is the website. We'll be back with more of Craig in just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
More information, go to citizen.org. And where is MJW? That?
Oh, the other one?
We'll get to that. We're back on the air. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Craig Holman with me, the government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen. You said 33 of the 44 largest spenders were government contractors. I'm assuming that all of those 44 are publicly traded company or not. I mean, Koch Industries, for example, is not a publicly traded company. There are some very, very large companies in this country that are not publicly traded, although they I believe Koch Industries has government contracts, don't they?
Koch industry does. And by the way, the Koch industries would be captured by the executive order.
Right. But not by the SEC.
Right, not by the SEC. I haven't done an analysis of how many of their 41 corporations that we looked at, the 41 big spenders, as to whether they're all publicly traded. Very probably most of them are. When you're talking about the big corporations, they tend to be the publicly traded corporations, and they also tend to be government contractors.
Right.
This would get a whole lot of that dark money out in the open. But I really do want to emphasize what's happening tomorrow,
okay,
if I can.
Yeah.
We're presenting a petition of five that's been signed so far by 500,000 Americans, half a million Americans. And if anyone else wants to sign before we present it on Thursday, go to citizen.org, and it's right there on our front page. You'll be able to sign it. And we will be presenting it to the White House in a rally outside the White House at noon on April 2nd, tomorrow, Thursday. And along with presenting the half million signatures, you know, we also have a 15-foot inflatable flashlight that we're going to use as a prop for casting light on all this dark money. So it's going to be quite a rally. There's not only the federal rally here at the White House, though. We have about 52 local rallies taking place all over the country, from Juneau, Alaska, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to Albany, New York, all over the place. And if anyone wants to participate in one of the local rallies, if you live in those areas, check out the website getmoneyoutaction.org.
Okay.
And that'll tell you where all the different local rallies are happening and at what time. And please join. Sign our petition and check out if there's a local rally near you that you can participate in.
Is that Where is Mary Jo White? Is that yours or is that somebody else's?
That's a separate web page. It's also managed by Public Citizen. That's whereismjw.com. That's focusing on the Securities Exchange
Right, and the SEC, which is not what you're doing tomorrow. But it's a kind of parallel track, good and important stuff.
That's right. I mean, we're pursuing every avenue we can. We're going to get transparency of money in politics sooner or later.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of these avenues, if not all of the avenues, are
wouldn't it be better just to get the money out of politics?
Well, it would be nice to have public financing. But right now we have to just get transparency.
Yeah.
Transparency is the floor upon which the rest of the house is built. And if we don't know where this money's coming from, you know, it's very hard to build the rest of a campaign finance system without knowing that. We need to first get the floor, and the floor is transparency. So that's our objective right now.
Right. Are there any real champions for this? Who are the people in the House? Well, Hank, we're hitting a break here. I'll ask you right after the break. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Craig Holman is with us from Public Citizen, citizen.org. Stick around. We'll be right back. To the bottom of the hour, and then we'll get back to your calls on all the various issues of the day. Craig, with Public Citizen, citizens.org, you've got this website, getmoneyoutaction.org. You've got a major event going on here in Washington, D.C., and literally from Alaska to the East Coast tomorrow. Tell us about it.
There are rallies going on all around the country. First of all, the one here in Washington, D.C. is at noon tomorrow, April 2nd. We're presenting a petition with a half a million signatures from citizens across the United States. And if anyone wants to sign, let me repeat, go to citizen.org, and it's right on our front page. Please sign before tomorrow at noon so we can present your name with half a million others. And then we're blowing up a 15-foot inflatable flashlight just as a prop to emphasize, you know, all we're asking is shining the light on this dark money. And then all around the country, there's about 52, the last I saw, local rallies taking place from Alaska to California to Minnesota to New York, literally every state. And you can find a local rally that you could join and participate in on our webpage at getmoneyoutaction.org. that posts where all the local rallies are.
GetMoneyOutAction.org. We'll get that up on our website if it's not already there, and push it out in our newsletter as well. Great stuff. Who in Congress is on your side? Who in Congress is in opposition to you? If we have people who are watching or listening in a particular state, who do they call? Do they call their senators? Do they call their members of the House of Representatives? Should they call the White House comment line, which I think is 202, what is it, 456-1111, as I recall?
I believe it is.
Yeah. And because you're the executive action here, you're pushing this to the White House, but sometimes the White House gets pushed by members of Congress as well. What's the best way for people, in addition, let's say somebody's already signed your petition and they can either come to town or show up for one of the gigs that's happening tomorrow or not, you know, but what else can they do?
You know, you ask who are the champions in Congress. This is the only place where this issue is partisan. Only on Capitol Hill and only in the Capitol are all Republicans opposed to transparency, or almost all Republicans, and all Democrats supporting transparency.
Really?
When you take a look at public opinion polls across the country, there is hardly any difference between Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. Everyone wants transparency of money in politics. Only on the Hill is it partisan. And the nature of the partisanship is amazing. We were almost getting this executive order back in 2011, and the congressional Republicans rallied and passed riders on appropriations bills prohibiting Obama from signing this executive order. And the Democrats support it, Republicans oppose it, but that's only on Capitol Hill. So if you want to call and try to apply some pressure, if you know a Republican member of Congress, or if your member is Republican, that makes the biggest difference right there.
Right.
All the Democrats are already on board. Senator Whitehouse, I mean, to play on the White House theme, I guess, I mean, he's one of our champions on the Senate side.
Sure.
Representative Van Hollen is our champion on the House side. But every Democrat really supports it, and almost every Republican is marching in lockstep against this.
I realize your organization is not partisan, and so you don't feel a need to react to this, but one of my mantras on this program is that in the Republican Party, there are basically three groups of people. There are the rich people, there are the paid shills for the rich people, and there are the suckers. And the job of the paid shills for the rich people is to keep the suckers voting in the interests of the rich people and against their own interests. And the rich people are the ones who are passing all that money to those Republicans. So, you know, if my analysis of the modern day Republican Party, this is not Dwight Eisenhower's Republican Party. If my analysis of it is accurate, that would make some sense for the partisan divide that you are talking about, which seems very unfortunate.
Except only on Capitol Hill. I really want to emphasize that.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
Republicans
do favor transparency. It's only the members of Congress who are Republicans who don't.
Yeah.
And so they can be perhaps that's where the influence needs to be applied. By the way, I'd like to digress a little bit. There was a news story that broke just about 2 days ago where there was this millionaire. I mean, this just shows how bad the money in politics is getting, and you know how far we've gone towards deregulation since Citizens United. A millionaire, her name is Terry Neese, is a major bundler, was a major bundler for the Romney campaign in 2012, and she was lamenting how now the money's getting so big that all the candidates are ignoring her and all the regular millionaires and just going towards the multimillionaires and the billionaires.
Right.
And
I read
she's
that article.
Feeling left out of the whole process here.
Yeah, she was feeling sorry for herself, as it were. Okay, so to just recap, Craig Holman is, we have just a minute here to the end of the segment. Craig Holman is with us. He's with Public Citizen. Citizen.org is the website. Get over to citizen.org right now. Sign that petition, which will be delivered to the president tomorrow, or at least to the White House, presumably to get to the president, right?
Yes.
Oh,
we've
yes.
been working with the White House staff as well.
Oh, great.
And the White House staff tends to be interested in this, although they can't commit themselves one way or the other.
Right.
So we actually got a chance. We have a chance here.
This is spectacular. And Get Money Out action.org. If you want to participate in one of these events tomorrow outside Washington, D.C., anywhere else in the country, or even in D.C., presumably, right?
Yes,
yeah,
that's right.
Okay. So, and that's where you can find out what's happening in your town. You can sign up. You can figure out where the details are, how all that sort of stuff, and participate. If this were to happen, what kind of timeline do you figure we're looking at?
It could be immediate. And an executive order would, as soon as it's signed, it takes effect. Now, the executive order would have to be designed in a way because of these Republican legislative obstructions.
Right.
They've prohibited disclosure. Can you imagine this? They've prohibited disclosure of political spending by contractors while they're negotiating a contract.
Oh, man.
But once the contract, once they get a contract, then the executive order can kick in and say, now you
disclose
the money.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
So call
202-536-2370.
Craig Holman, citizen.org, and getmoneyoutaction.org. Get over, check it out. Thanks so much, Craig, for being here.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks.
Great talk. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this, for those here, I don't know if he'll say anything to anybody. Probably not. This is Blue. I'm holding in my hand. It's our hey, Blue, can you woof, woof? No? No woofs? We've been trying to teach him not to bark. He's a miniature Australian sheepdog. And what was the old line from National Lampoon? Go to citizen.org and sign the petition or we shoot the dog. No. It's April Fools. Just kidding. Anyhow, I just wanted to introduce you to my dog. Sorry he didn't say anything. He's a nice, quiet little dog. Anyway, that said, oh, my. Let's pick up some phone calls here. There's so much to talk about. Grant in Ventura, California. Hey, Grant, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to introduce you and your viewers to Kevin Cruz of Princeton University. He's a historian, and he looks at industrialism and capitalism's influence on religion.
Huh.
And he does quite a good bit of investigative journalism on it. And he shows how big business was against FDR's policies. And so they bought off religious leaders.
I read that piece. We talked about it on the air last week. They funded Billy Graham and a couple of other of these right-wing guys.
Yeah, and behind it was DuPont, Heinrich Ford, Chase Morgan, General Motors, American Liberty.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing. The modern Christian right was in large part invented by business in the 1930s as, you know, a new group of suckers that the Republicans could bring in to oppose FDR and the New Deal. It's remarkable. Grant, thank you for pointing that out, bringing it back up. I need to visit that more often, and we should really get the guy on as a guest. Rick in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, Rick, you wanted to talk about religion?
Well, actually, Tom, I called about something else. Since you've thrown it open, I'd like to go back to my original topic.
Sure.
Which was campaign finance reform. Mm-hmm. Your last guest talked about transparency for a limited number of donors. So we know who's buying the elections. But, of course, as you pointed out, what we need to do is actually eliminate the source of that corruption. So I've talked to you about this idea several times, and we've never really explored it on the air. But the idea is we make support for a constitutional amendment a campaign issue. Now, I ran in 2010 for the U.S. Senate on a promise to introduce a constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United.
Yeah.
But you were not interested in talking about it then on the air. There were over three dozen candidates who took that position, by the way, in 2010. And Public Citizen was trying to publicize this. So ever since then, you know, I've been calling you repeatedly trying to bring this up, and we've never had a discussion about it. Well, I don't know if you know, but Move to Amend, who you constantly promote, actually came out in support of the idea in 2014. And I don't think it got enough publicity. And we need people like you to help get the idea out there. So I'm wondering, what do you think about the idea now? I mean, you said you've heard about it many times from other people, too, last time you and I talked.
The idea being?
Well, the idea is if you're going to pass a constitutional amendment, obviously you need to get two-thirds of both houses.
Right.
The only way you're going to do that
or three quarters of the states.
People who will vote for it.
Oh.
Now we know that.
Yeah, I got it. I understand what you're saying. I am totally in favor of electing people who are in favor of a constitutional amendment, and I support Citizens United in that, Rick. And if you're running for office again, I wish you the very best. Thank you for the call. Patty in Shelton, Washington. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Hi. Actually, they lost me on the whatnot. I'm Patty from Harstein Island. I'm outside of Shelton.
Oh, okay.
Hi. Good day to you again. Your crowd did you proud while you were gone. And I have a slight different take. So a tiny rant, and then I'll ask you.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these Republican states have enacted these religious freedom laws. And Indiana says that the parties have a right to bring legal action to prevent a likely burden on religious belief even before a burden is imposed. These same Republican states are the ones that have enacted the ag-gag laws, where you can be arrested for cruelty to animals. Now, here's my take.
Now, you can be arrested for exposing corporate cruelty to animals.
Exposing, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. But here's where I think we should take ugly against ugly. Why don't, as a person who is Christian, who believes in the care of the animals and the dominion over the animals, and Hindus who believe the cow is sacred, why don't we use this ugly religious freedom law against the ugly ag-gag laws and let ugly fight ugly on behalf of our love for animals?
So how would you do that?
Well, it would be a class action suit. According to the law, it says that it just has to provide a likely burden. It doesn't have to actually occur.
Right.
It would be a class action suit with probably people who believe the cow is sacred or people who believe that we're supposed to care for the animals, which goes up against the cruelty of animals in the ag-gag law.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Also, the religious freedom, all of our gay brothers and sisters have to go and get a license to get married or a license to have a business. To dissolve that marriage or dissolve that business, you also have to go back. You're going into a we the people paid for facility.
Right.
We the people paid for the salaries. It's taxation without representation. It's all ugly.
Yeah.
I thought we could use one ugly against the other. What do you think?
Sure. Thank you, Patty. And thank you for the call. It's an interesting concept. In all the other states, by the way, and the federal, quote, Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, all they do is prevent the government from impinging on your religious freedom. The Indiana law, and now the, I believe, Arkansas law, which the governor is refusing to sign, the Indiana law allows businesses to assert an affirmative defense against a lawsuit from an individual who has been discriminated against by the business, not by the government, but by the business. So I wonder, it's kind of like a, it's fairly convoluted, but I wonder if somebody could assert, and probably a Hindu or a Buddhist could do this most easily, that their religion forbids them from eating meat, or a Jew could do it, or a Muslim about pork, and therefore sue a business for serving it because it offends us. I don't know. I think that's it's probably pretty thin ice, but anyhow, it needs to be worked out and formed. Tim in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I think you should make a distinction between the difference between religion and spirituality, right? Religion is an organization. Spirituality is a personal, subjective experience.
Well, that was my fourth category, was the transcendence category. Yeah,
I don't think it's appropriate to discuss the transcendent part in the context of religion, which is simply an organization.
Right?
Transcendence is a spiritual thing.
Right.
It's a private, subjective thing. You can't prove it to anybody.
Right.
So I would make those distinctions between the organizational aspects and genuine, personal spirituality. The next thing I thought I would bring up is the freedom of religion is really the freedom to teach others your interpretation, right? The expression of religion is really different because other people's rights could be impacted by my expression of my religion.
Depending on how you do it.
It becomes a civil matter.
Yeah. Yeah, if you decide that you're going to stone your neighbor's kid because he talked back to you, even though it says to do so in Deuteronomy, or because he's worshiping idols or something, we really don't approve of that anymore.
Agreed. And so you can go, it goes all the way back to them chasing the Gnostics out of town.
Yeah. 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 Fascinating stuff. Tim, thank you. Yeah, it is an important distinction between institutions and personal experience. It's a very important distinction. James in Hammond, Indiana. Hey, James, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom, apparently, Indiana already has a law that says any business can refuse you service because, let me explain. I retired from the military last July after 26 years of service, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I get a retirement fund, right? Okay, now, when I came home, not only did I come back to Hammond, Indiana, where I was born, I came back and bought a home on the street where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, on the corner, there's a store that the Veterans Administration directs us to use its ATM machine.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't get charged fees out from this machine.
Right.
We use our card.
Right.
Now, I went in there one day, and this owner, he just said, I don't want you in here anymore.
Really?
I said, what are you mean? Yeah, he said, I don't want you in there anymore. He said, because the girl told me that you tried to cheat her.
Huh.
So I said, you are mistaken. I said, the only reason I come in this store is because I use the ATM machine that the Veterans Administration directed me to use.
Amazing. James, it seems like you need a good lawyer. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, it's really tragic, and I've never been involved in a lawsuit. I don't recommend them generally, but sometimes that's what you have to do. And welcome back, Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. It was nice meeting you out in L.A. I don't know if you remember, but
thank you.
I wanted to clear something up that you've been talked about off and on many, many times, and it has nothing to do with the subject of today, although I have some comments. The reason that no one can ever bring charges of negligent homicide, wrongful death, any damage done to you is based on something that I tried to fight for a woman named Nadia McCaffrey, who worked with Cindy Sheehan, and they were mothers of sons. They started Gold Star Mothers, and I worked for 2 years and with the ACLU to try to bring state law, as you have suggested, on the different forms of murder charges against all the administration.
So a variation on Vince Bugliosi's theory.
Well, here's the problem. There's a doctrine, a decision that was made called the Ferris Doctrine. The Ferris Doctrine is a doctrine that bars, that was decided by I don't know, the family of someone who was in an army barracks, no less, not in a war, and the barracks burned down, and it was in 1950. It was Ferris versus the United States. The decision of that doctrine stops you from even suing the companies that supply the army. Its main point is it's a doctrine that bars claims against the federal government by members of the armed forces and their families for injuries arising or in the course of activity. And here's the main phrase, incident to military service.
Hmm.
They have complete immunity and you cannot beat it. Even the people that got blown up in the Columbia accident, I believe it was Columbia, right?
What about the folks who got electrocuted because I think it was Halliburton. It was one of the contractors over in Iraq was, you know, doing shoddy wiring, and they electrified the showers, and a couple of our soldiers died. Were they not able to successfully sue either the government or the contractors, or did that get stopped by this Ferris Doctrine also?
I would assume, unless you know the results,
I don't
look up the case, but there were people that have died in private company provided things like helicopters that were negligently built, and all kinds of suits that if it was outside of the armed services, you would be able to bring suit.
Right.
Okay, you know what, Tom? I know I have a short period of time, but if you look up the Ferris Doctrine, you will see the case. It has applied. Every lawyer, everybody warned me that I would not be able to bring charges because he was reported as killed in action, as was Cindy Sheehan's son, and I think the athlete, I forget his name, in Afghanistan.
We have a half a minute, Bob. How did it work out?
Real quickly. Mark Twain and the Ethical Culture Society. Ethical Culture Society is a deist religion. They joined together in the 1898 anti-imperialist league. It's wonderful for anybody that lives in New York side. They got started for humane causes and fought the Spanish-American War. Mark Twain was president of the anti-imperialist league to 1910, I think, when he died. Last, American corporations. They are now people. They can now be treated as people. They can be criminals. Why can't we charge them with crimes if they are people?
Oh, we charge them with crimes. We just don't put them in jail. We have them pay fines, as Jamie Dimon.
No, like murder.
No, I agree with you. I'm absolutely with you, Bob. Thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ani in Los Angeles on the line. Is that the Ani who was on my show last week?
Yes, it was. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Ani. How are you?
Good, good, good. I wanted to call in regards to ENDA. I don't know if you've heard of this, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which basically allows for religious institutions to discriminate against LGBTs. Obviously, it died in the House. And they had to negotiate, and they had to drop the word trans in order to pass it through one aspect of this bill.
Uh-huh.
But again, it's this legislation. It is bending to accommodate the religious institutions. And in my particular view, as a Muslim and as a progressive Muslim, I see this as no different than Sharia law being implemented in Muslim majority countries, where one's religious belief system is legislated for the population. And I think I don't know if you've heard of ENDA, but it really is not much different in our legislation process, where the Christian right is basically legislating their religious beliefs.
Yeah, it's the Christian Taliban. We have a Christian Taliban here in the United States. It's maybe that's the wrong phrase, but I think most Americans would get it. So, is there, first of all, Ani, what the website for Muslims for Progressive Values? It's mpvusa.org, correct?
Yes, that's
okay,
correct.
Okay, great. For your organization, do you have information at that link about this topic?
Not about ENDA, because we've been supportive of ENDA, as an organization, in collaboration with other faith organizations, but, if your listeners Google Employment Non-Discrimination Act ENDA, there's a lot of information out there. Yeah.
Great. Okay, cool. Ani, thank you very much for the call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Great talking with you. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to tell you about, I agree with the guy who was talking about spirituality versus religion.
Mm-hmm.
And my opinion about man-made religious rules in every religion, there's some religions that even don't allow their people to vote. So yet they will still take the Medicare, they'll still take the Social Security, they'll still take all that stuff. But
are you talking about some of the fundamentalist cults like the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yes.
They can't have flags, they can't vote, they can't participate because they don't recognize civil government.
Right, because to them that would be betraying, you know, their version of God.
Right.
But yet they don't hesitate to take the financial aids that the government puts up there, yet they won't vote.
Right. And they certainly make use of their nonprofit status.
Exactly.
Excellent
exactly.
point. Excellent point. Denise, thank you for calling and making it. David in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hey, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Here's a partial solution to homophobia and bigotry and the fall of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long shot, though. The Old Testament versus the New Testament. The Old Testament preaches hate, you know, distrust, and just, I mean, genocide at Jericho and, you know, fantasy. And Genesis was basically ripped off from the Sumerian Gilgamesh,
mm-hmm.
as was Noah's trip down the aisle
right.
as an infant. There was from Zara.
Well, a lot of stuff in the New Testament is also, you know, predates both Christianity and Judaism. But what's your point?
The point is, the Bible was put together from 325 to the next few hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus did not say anything about including any of the Old Testament.
Actually, he said...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
He said, I have come to fulfill the law, not to change it. That's the one thing that a lot of these fundies will quote, saying, oh, no, all that Deuteronomy stuff still stands. And then on the other hand, he, you know, at another point, he said, you know, there is, you know, they said, what's the most important law to follow? And he said, you know, love your neighbor as yourself and love God above all else. And that was, the sum of all the commandments. But I, you know, without getting into a huge theological discussion here.
Well, three of the commandments, one of them forbids heretics, one of them forbids blasphemy,
right.
and the other is iconograph. It's like if we just didn't include that in the Bible, because it's the primary source for teaching so many religious peoples, for all three religions,
right. yeah.
we would eliminate so much of the early programming that kids go through.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to mention, you know, nobody believes, or let's say nobody that has any scientific background believes in any of the first five books as far as...
Well, there are different people who interpret these things in different ways, but my personal opinion is that the way that we should be discussing this in our schools and with our young people is in the context of comparative religion, comparing one religion with another. And so people are informed, but not necessarily proselytized. Thank you for the call. Van in Gordonsville, Virginia. Hey, Van, what's up?
Hello there. I wanted to talk about spirituality in religion.
Okay.
And you hit on a couple of these things already.
We have just 1 minute left, Van.
The main thing I was interested in is that I think Jesus explained the Ten Commandments in that they're the result of loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The result.
Right.
The Ten Commandments are not things anybody can keep unless you do love God and unless you love your neighbor as yourself. I think that's the primary thing that you have to do to have a religion is the spirituality. It's all based on spirituality, not on what rules people tell you to do. It's people telling you to do these things, not the spirituality.
Right, and by extension, you're defining spirituality as including love.
Your spirit, God is love.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I have a dog, too.
John
I have
4.
Two dogs. Now, I love my dogs almost more than people, but they show you what true love is.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And so do people from time to time. Van, thanks so much for the call. Thank you so much for being with us these 3 hours today. I hope you have a wonderful day today, and we will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you. Tag your it. Get over to citizen.org and sign that petition so that your name can be on that stack of papers that gets delivered to Barack Obama, to President Obama tomorrow. Citizen.org. Check it out. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.